Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is Sunday, August 9th. You're going to be hearing this Monday, August 10th. Or, you know what? Anytime after that, that works for you. I mean, that's part of the genius of this media format, podcasting. It's super convenient. So it could be some situation far in the future that I can't even envision. You've been on some kind of quest. It's a post-apocalyptic world. You stumble across the wreckage of an old airplane and you're looking for non-perishable food. I don't know what your situation is. And you find, you know, an old tape player and a bunch of cassette tapes because after the internet went away, everybody had to transfer the podcast they like to this old and substandard but reliable format. So there you are. Thanks for joining us.
And yes, I realize that the turn that that story took is not a good argument in support of the convenience of podcasting. Thanks for coming, though. However you're listening, however you got here.
So repost today, I actually did this discussion weeks ago with Bob Murphy, but we talk about fascism and progressivism and public schools, so it's quite timeless. And you're going to hear the latter two-thirds of the conversation. The first third is like background information. You've heard me do these interviews where I'm like, yeah, you know, I went to school, didn't like it. Then believe it or not, I tried teaching in a school, liked it less. Took all that angst and spun it into a career as a podcaster. Super convenient media format, by the way, podcasting is. So if you want to hear that, if you're new and you don't know that stuff, there's a link for the full episode in the show notes. Bob is great. Bob's show is great. And it was a pleasure and a privilege to be a part of it. I also sped up a segment where we talk about school history. So if you're already listening to this at like 1.5 times speed, which I appreciate it if you do that because it makes me sound a lot smarter, that part is going to be intense because my voice is sped up. The tempo is sped up. I just wanted to get through it because I assume a lot of people who are listening to this already know that. And a lot of other segments in this conversation you're about to hear are new looks at familiar topics. So I thank Bob for his contributions. I also just want to let everyone know, on August 5th, we celebrated the 11th anniversary, quiet celebration. I was actually on vacation, but we celebrated the 11th anniversary of School Sucks Podcast. So I just want to say thank you to all of you who take time to listen to the show, obviously. But, you know, I'll go and I'll post something on social media. You'll share it. You'll like my post, if you know what I mean. And, of course, everybody who supports the show through Patreon or the AV Club to keep this project going and growing. But, yes, August 5th is our anniversary, and it's also the birthday of a friend and a collaborator named Joel Byne. I did an interview for his podcast, Exponentially Empowered, recently, and you will hear that on Wednesday, then on Friday, but perhaps on Monday, because we like to save our Fridays for free bonuses, and I have a whole bunch of fun stuff that I want to share with you. So let's say it's going to be next Monday. Nick Runlett and I are continuing our career launch stories series, where we talk to, right now, Praxis graduates about how they use that program as an overpass around the whole college rotary. And we have a great conversation that I did record last week when I was on vacation with Nick's friend and colleague, Logan. So there's a lot coming your way in the next 7 days. Also, just want to mention that in the show notes for this show and every other show, students in Richard Grove's autonomy course that I interact with in weekly meetings, you know, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 9:30 a.m., I do weekly kind of a wrap session on a variety of topics for people who are in autonomy or people who either attended or purchased the digital downloadable version of the SSP University Ideas into Action Summit. That's linked in the show notes as well if you're interested in learning more about that. So I'm having a great time interacting with those people every week, and they put together this very cool, very useful, easy win PDF called 19 Essential Skills for Success Not Taught in School. If that sounds like something you need, or something you think you could have a, you know, positive impact on somebody by sharing it, go and grab it, please. Do me a favor, go and grab it, please. And that is it for today. I will be back on Wednesday with Joel Bine and Exponentially Empowered. And I hope you enjoy this episode, two-thirds of this episode, of The Bob Murphy Show. Thank you, Bob, for having me. And thank you for listening. And take care.
So I do want to come back in a moment, and I've even written a note to myself. It's like a test-taking skill. You write notes down. So I don't forget to come back to, like, to focus specifically on the school history and, you know, Horace Mann and Prussian model and all that stuff. But just more generally, to finish that train of thought, I'm curious, because the reason, again, this is the top of my mind, is I was watching a different documentary where they were making the case that, you know, like, hey, doesn't it seem like no matter what the issue is, there's like 19 different things, like the environmental movement and whatever, abortion and this and that. So the guy, this was coming from a Christian conservative perspective, and all these different things, you know, no easy divorce laws and and all this stuff, you know, the public schools. And even though they seem on the surface to be wildly different things, yet it's always paving the way towards the government taking over every aspect of your life from cradle to grave. And so he was, you know, the whole premise of this documentary, and that's what they were bringing up, the Fabian socialists and quotes from like Bertrand Russell that are shocking from the 50s and stuff, saying this isn't a coincidence and this isn't a conspiracy theory. This stuff is all out in the open. Here, we can go read to you. And they're quoting from various people saying, this is our plan to take over society. And so the question, like, so the only issue would be, is it, oh no, it really was just a dumb coincidence, and these explicitly admitted socialists and or communists who wrote about the theory of this just got lucky and other people happened to do the things that they recommended, but it wasn't because those other people were trying to further that. You get what I'm saying? Like, it's a neat little theory, and I'm just wondering, you know, is that reading too much into it? And yeah, just because some guy said something in 1905 about this is how communism would take over doesn't mean that actually happened. It just kind of, the growth of big government is what it was. And
yeah, I mean, well, I think it's more like the Rahm Emanuel way of thinking, never let a crisis go to waste. People have waited in the wings with these designs on society. They infiltrate institutions. I know infiltrate is kind of a pointed word and maybe makes them sound more diabolical, but these are people who are committed to these projects and they know the places that they have to go, right? They go to state capitals. You can go to the most conservative states in the country and the capitals are overrun with liberals and progressives, right? You know, like Oregon is, I was out in Oregon a couple years ago. It's a state of farmers and, you know, leave me aloneers. Mm-hmm. That entire population is controlled by what goes on in two cities, Portland and Salem. Massachusetts, believe it or not, is very similar, where outside of Boston, you go into the western part of that state and it's like the South, you know, New York is upstate. New York is the same thing. So, you know, these people understood where they needed to position themselves to have this kind of influence. Obviously, right from the beginning, it wasn't just political, it was academic. And, you know, today, certainly in the last like 50 to 70 years, that positioning has been in the media as well. So people who are pushing for these ideas or socialism generally have an enormous kind of cultural head start in that outside of politics, and you know this all too well, they have disproportionate control and influence in academia and disproportionate control and influence in media. So they are in the places they need to be to use that Fabian expression, strike hard when the time comes.
Well, can I ask you, I guess you might be answered, but because again, you're right, Rahm Emanuel, never let a crisis go to waste. But on the other hand, I don't know if you're familiar with Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine.
Refresh my memory. I know Naomi Klein's book sounds really
familiar. She relies heavily on, I guess, Milton Friedman used, you know, had a correspondence with Pinochet. And the idea was the public is not at all in favor of your radical laissez-faire ideas, Chicago school economists. And so they knew and were telling, you know, dictators on the right, the only way you're going to ram this through is wait till there's a crisis. And then while the public is reeling because, you know, the currency crashed or whatever, that's when you implement your free trade, you know, cut off welfare benefits, tie your currency to the dollar, you know, do all the stuff that's crazy and not so from her perspective, it was, you know, these evil libertarian right wingers who would wait for a crisis and then go ahead and run through. And they're called the shock doctrine because Friedman, I'm paraphrasing, but said something like, if you're going to go ahead and do this stuff, do it all right away. If you phase it in, it's going to prolong the agony, like sort of rip the Band-Aid off kind of thing. So she wasn't putting words, but Friedman did say that stuff. And also, like, I would say, like, you know, if Ron Paul is going to be president, I would say, yeah, do his agenda right away, because then there's going to be a bad recession. Unemployment might go to 15%, but then we'll get over it. Whereas if you kind of do it piecemeal, his whole first term would be bad. You know what I mean? So it's true. But my question to you is, you know, given that in principle that should work both ways, why does it seem like, no, every crisis was always ratcheting it towards a big government? How come when there was, you know, with each crisis, it wasn't people saying, you know, we've been trying bigger government and things keep the crises keep getting worse. Maybe we should go the other way. Why is it every crisis proves how laissez-faire capitalism doesn't work? Even though if you asked the week before the crisis, do we have laissez-faire capitalism? They'd say, no, that would be nutty, because then there'd be crises.
Yeah, I think, and this is just an observation from the last few years, is that a crisis is no time to look back, right? Mm-hmm. Because libertarians are real annoying. They always go, you know, if you had done this, just in 1912, if this had happened instead of this, and people go, sorry, idiot, it's 2008.
Right.
And we're in the middle of the biggest crisis we've ever faced in our lives, and we need to go forward. And that, so this can't be some academic exploration of what might have been 95 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's like the crisis is here now. I mean, that's why the crisis is such a perfect time to strike, because I think especially when you have this kind of mass fear, obviously the capacity for reason is dramatically reduced, and, and people will always accept these dramatic. I mean, look at what people have swallowed just in the last like 4 or 5 months,
right,
in this country, right? Government on the state and federal level seized that opportunity. And now there are other examples that I think are better as far as looking at the past versus how to go forward. But I think just the simple answer is people don't want to suddenly become involved in some academic exploration of cause and effect when the crisis is actually upon us. So libertarians in these conversations are kind of pigeonholed or caricatured as the people who have no solutions, right? Mm-hmm. You have no solutions. You're just talking about how it could have been if something different happened way in the past, right? Which kind of excludes us from the conversation, which I think is why this ratcheting effect just continues.
Yeah. Okay. I like that.
Yeah.
And also, I think you're right that the people who are in the relevant positions, like the media, like in terms of framing the conversation, to like to not say, geez, look at how the Fed blew up the housing bubble. That's not something people would have gotten from CBS or something as of 2008. Right. That they are populated by leftists. And again, so the question was just, oh, is that just because, you know, our artsy people tend to be on the left? Or like, was it a deliberate strategy? I'm saying there were Saul Alinsky, take your pick, his mentor, you know, going back saying, yeah, right now we don't have the votes. The culture's against us, you know, the people believe in their God or whatever. So let's go ahead and, take over the schools, and it was like a strategy like this. So anyway, can we go back to, because I do want to talk about the virus stuff, because I know you got a whole project on that that's interesting, but can we go back to the Horace Mann and the Prussian model? Just for those who don't know, it's not the case that from time immemorial, it was assumed that, you have a kid, and then when he reaches 5 years old or something, you hand them over 8 hours a day to get tutored by public school teachers. Like, where did that come from, that concept?
Yeah, and I think we already hinted at this a little bit, that this was really the story of the boiled frog as far as the American people are concerned. It's interesting that we brought up Fabianism, because there was a very Fabian approach to this. And
You know, I just think the whole school story is this increasing leverage of scientific managers or people who have these designs on society through three revolutions. And they were all, interestingly, they're all safe space roughly like a half a century apart. So the initial incursion is the Horace Mann traveler's reports, where lots of people in industrial countries, so this included France, England, and the United States, were looking at places in the world that they thought were, I don't know, something worth aspiring to. And one of those places was Central Europe in the middle of the 1800s in this kingdom of Prussia. Actually, this goes back to the early 1800s. So the Prussian system is very much about industrial and military obedience. And this is something that in the United States, in the middle of the 1800s, you have a coming industrial revolution and you have the end of the slave system. So having an institution that you can use as kind of a forge to not only standardize, oh, you also have a huge immigrant influx starting around that time too. So to set up an institution as a forge where you can get a predictable, standardized, and obedient citizenry out of it, like this is first introduced to people as a kind of conspiracy theory. If you could, nothing else would have made sense at that time than to import a system like this. If the system already existed and had already been like paying dividends for the aristocracy of Prussia and other places in Central Europe, why not bring it to the United States? Why not bring it to the United Kingdom? Why not bring it to France? So I would say that was the first and probably the most important revolution as far as shifting from what existed before to a collectivist approach. I mean, that was really it. It was family and community-based education to an industrial collectivist schooling. Right? Mm-hmm. And 50 or so years later, it was the progressives who were seeking more of a secular utopia, people like John Dewey, who entered into, they didn't obliterate the Prussian foundation, right? Because you see how something that teaches obedience, conformity, and as a result produces a kind of intellectual apathy. Because, you know, if you're outsourcing your ability to make decisions, or you're surrendering individuality to, the will of the group, or the need of fitting into a group, it's an understandable impulse. But if those are the practices that school is teaching, obviously the outcome is going to be a kind of, you know, intellectual, moral, spiritual apathy, right? If you've outsourced all that other stuff. So, everybody understands, everybody wants to control the schools, understands its power. So the progressives are, just like it is today, we have the best ideas, we're the most responsible, the most moral, we're the party of science. So a lot of the science they were promoting back then would be extremely controversial today, things like eugenics. Mm-hmm. But they were the responsible scientific managers, and they understood that the forge could be used for their purposes. So schooling took a more progressive shape in the first half of the 20th century. And then it took a kind of behaviorist metric turn in the 1960s and 70s, where principles of Skinner's behaviorism were used to basically start this standardized test revolution, right? And what is often called outcomes-based education, which sounds nice and sounds responsible, but what was discovered by people who researched this in the 80s and 90s was outcomes-based education was very much about producing certain attitudinal outcomes in students. So using behaviorism plus, the science, these measurement sciences to form the attitudes, to better form the attitudes. You think this is an outgrowth of the 1960s where there's all kinds of cultural revolution and iconoclasm happening, and you know, that's not the best thing. That's very unpredictable. So I think this is kind of a response to that. And through outcomes-based education, we get things like Goals 2000 under Bill Clinton, No Child Left Behind under George Bush, and Common Core under Barack Obama.
So, I mean, that's the story in the nutshell, but that first revolution, that first incursion of the Prussian schooling is such a dramatic shift, taking the responsibility of education away from families and communities and transferring it to the state.
Yeah, so folks, I'll link to, Brett, I was mentioning before the show, I looked at you've got this YouTube video that's got like 198,000 views right now called The American Way, and it links to Nazi Germany. And it, anyway, great stuff telling the story. Since I said something that provocative, do you want to just give a very quick explanation? Like, what are you talking about? Whoa, Nazis, what do you mean?
Yeah, and I will warn people that my most popular YouTube videos are not logically my strongest arguments.
Right.
Which there are obviously lots of things left out of this video. It's about 8 minutes long, and I think it's called something like The American Way, Our Connection to Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. It parallels like a lot of what was happening in the United States around, I guess, 2010, 2011. So we're thinking about things like the TSA, increased controls over the economy after the 2008 financial crisis, the expansion of the police state. And it's paralleling this to the rise of Nazism in Germany in the 30s. The video received so much criticism and hate that I wound up doing, I think, 7 or 8 hours of podcast content expanding it. It was just called The American Way Expanded. Mm-hmm. So we talked about how, Germany was very much a gasoline-soaked house. The causal relationships that we learn in story in school about, you know, the story of Hitler, the rise of Nazism leading into World War II, like, according to what I remember from high school, World War II starts when Hitler invades Poland, right? Mm-hmm. That's chapter one of World War II scholarship in high school. So
if you're lucky, they might say, oh, the Treaty of Versailles was harsh and they had reparations that were high. And then, you know, Hitler said, why are we paying this stuff or something like that?
Right. Yeah. I think you would learn that. The problem is it's just in an earlier chapter in your book, right? So even if it's mentioned again, you don't really see like the cause and effect of that. You don't see what happened in that sort of 20-year period of finger quotes peace between the two wars. Mm-hmm. So, I think there's a lot missing, obviously, from the way the story is taught in school. But one of the conclusions that I made was these were both societies, what we were seeing in the United States 10 years ago and what we saw happening in Germany in the 30s into the 40s were both highly schooled societies, right? That had systems that taught this kind of obedience, that taught this kind of conformity. And again, it goes to that Peterson idea of like, you think you wouldn't be a Nazi, young American college student, if you had grown up in that situation? You were schooled to be that. Peterson doesn't say that, but I mean, I will add that to his statement confidently. So it's a lot to cram into 8 minutes. It obviously misses a lot, but I think it's for people who are curious about the claims of that video, there's tons more content that it shows Germany was obviously, like we're talking about with the Treaty of Versailles, a gasoline-soaked house, right? Hitler was a match that got thrown at it,
right?
You know, and we all know basically what happened next. In that series, you know, we talk about some of the philosophical problems, that container that Germany was in, Kant, Hegel, how those ideas, even Nietzsche, how there could be a perversion or a twisting of those ideas to basically offer a philosophical justification or support for the rise of somebody like Hitler through a misunderstanding of some of those philosophies. Not that those philosophies, I think, are perfect anyway, and just were perverted into that. The economic problems, obviously, the cost that Germany had to pay after the First World War. One of the things that I actually missed in that series was a lot of the cultural problems. You know, the Weimar Republic was having a like very America in the second decade of the 21st century kind of cultural thing happening, right? In the 20s and the 30s, and there were a lot of people who had, you know, more traditional values in Germany who were really tired of that. And they felt like, look, this is a first world country, and you know, we're going to lose it to some kind of like socialist or some communist revolution. So the fact that like a right wing or somebody who positioned themselves as right wing in a lot of ways, strong man could rise to power from that. I think I missed that in that video and in the series. But obviously, I would say that the parallels have only continued to emerge between our two societies. And Leonard Peikoff from the objectivist world wrote a book like in the mid 80s called Ominous Parallels.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I would say like it was an easy thing to do after 9/11 and the fallout from 9/11 to link those two worlds. But, you know, Peikoff does it 15 years before 9/11, just kind of tracing, I think, more of the philosophical similarities and the cross, the collaboration between the United States and Germany. I mean, there was a lot of it, right? I mean, America took their school system. Germany took some of their ideas about eugenics from American progressive higher education, you know, and just put them into practice, which is how they disappeared from America, you know? Like once progressives saw them practiced, it was like, well, you know, maybe instead of like killing and sterilizing these people, we should try to be more like their parents or something.
Right.
Try a new approach, right? Yeah, that's the story.
And that's interesting too, that progression that, you know, you're saying Leonard Peikoff in the 80s seeing like was documenting the philosophical similarities when to most observers it would look like, no, we don't look like Nazi Germany. Whereas after, you know, during George W. Bush's administration, plenty of people on the left had no problem calling him Hitler.
Yeah.
And so, but that makes sense, like for people who care about philosophy or whatever, that's kind of the point that, yeah, before stuff happens on the ground, there was the previous generation of thinkers and philosophers who had dangerous ideas that were being batted around, you know, academia or whatever. And then the concrete, tangible fruits of that wouldn't show up until later.
Right. Yeah, or people could just find in them justifications for things that they wanted to do.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't we, can we switch then to your project? You alluded to it. This stuff, like you're having experts on the COVID-19 stuff kind of go head to head, or at least you're trying to facilitate that.
Yeah, well, it's not like I'm moderating debates between people. It's like we're trying to compare and contrast to find a more complete picture of what's going on. So mm-hmm. a friend of mine who's actually an Eastern medical practitioner, his name's Daryl Becker, he's been co-hosting this series with me. And I think one of the observations is a lot of like the social political response and a lot of what we see on social media to COVID has a real like wag the dog feel to it. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah.
So the sort of behind the scenes of how these synthetic narratives can be produced and how perceptions can be managed. So I said, all right, well, there's certainly a lot of BS going on here. And some people will see like, oh, there's an attempt to, this is propaganda. This is an attempt at some kind of manipulation. So the entire thing must be false. So that enter like somebody like David Icke, who will step forward and boldly say there is no coronavirus. There is no COVID-19. All right. That's a position. Does it go all the way to the end? Or where does the truth stop and the false begin? Right. So that was an investigation that I wanted to take on. And I think, at this point, when I realize how much you have to kind of zoom in and zoom out, right, to like big picture, to like really trying to understand the fine details behind like the RT-qPCR tests and, you know, is the virus properly sequenced, is the genome of the virus sequenced, like all of these things, and like to the broader, like what are the implications for all of society? It's just been an exhausting exercise. It's taken a lot of time. And I think that what I'm hoping to model is that people can disagree about this and not melt down. Mm-hmm. My co-host and I don't see eye to eye, but we've had at this point, I think like 6 or 7 hours of conversation about it. And more importantly is this idea that I think Connor Boyack, you're familiar with him, right? Mm-hmm. I think he coined this term inquiry over information. A lot of people look at something as vast as the whole COVID-19 controversy, and they just say, oh, I'll never understand it, so I'm going to submit to trusting, you know, in some cases, it's the World Health Organization and the CDC and CNN, and in some cases, it's David Icke, maybe it's Tucker Carlson, but a person is going to have, like, this is my go-to.
Right.
On this, well, a person becomes a go-to in our media environment because they have a very clear, decisive, uncurious position carved out about this thing, right? There's no curiosity about any of this on CNN, except like, how can we make it scarier?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Fox has their position. Obviously, the conspiracy world has their position. So people go to the comfort of you know, outsourcing their thinking to one of these positions. And I think just saying, look, I'm not invested in any conclusion. I know we have a need to make meaning, but like understanding this thing 100% accurately is probably, I don't have the capacity for that, right? I don't have the years to invest in doing the background science. So what I am more interested in is the process of inquiry and speaking out from, you know, the platform that I have to say, I am inquiring. I think the world needs more. Not, I know this is a little bit self-aggrandizing, but the world needs more people who are saying, hey, everyone, I'm inquiring. And that's what I'd like to like broadcast from my platform. Instead of saying, I have the information. I know the right answer. Because the truth is, most people are out there going, I'm never going to have the right information, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to actually inquire, right? So to Connor Boyack's idea of, not that he's wrapped up in this controversy in any way, maybe I shouldn't have tied those two things together, but his very general idea of prioritize the process of inquiry over, you know, being sure that you gain the correct information, and then even worse, marrying your identity or your worth to the information or the conclusion that it brings about. So I'm adding something to what he said because he was talking about it more in terms of self-directed education. But I think that is a really important thing to engage in. We might not have the right answers. We might not get the complete picture. It's also extremely fluid and dynamic. So it's hard to catch up with it, right? There's always new information emerging about this thing. So just to kind of commit to a process of I'm trying to learn and my identity isn't tied to any conclusion or position mm-hmm. about this, I think is a worthwhile exercise. So that's the project that we're working
okay,
on
well,
now.
Okay, well, yeah, I like that a lot. Let me be a little bit more explicit, you know, because especially if people follow my Twitter account or something, they can kind of tell from my trolling. So I've decided what I am. I'm anti-mask when it comes to this stuff. And what I mean by that is, so with Trump, it's not that I'm pro-Trump, I'm anti-anti-Trump. And what happened was the attacks that I saw from people, in this case from the progressive left on Trump, in many cases were so dumb that it started making me sympathize with him, even though I wasn't for him. And so with the mask, like I've seen a lot of libertarians, and by the way, just so you understand the context, Brett, my wife has a serious lung issue. And so we were wearing N95 masks, you know, from the beginning, like back when the government was still telling us not to. Right. So I've seen, just to give you an example of what I mean, people will say stuff like, so one thing is that lately, I don't know why, but all of a sudden masks are a hot button issue again the last 2 weeks, but they are for some reason, at least on my feed. And the Surgeon General had something from March saying, don't buy masks. They're not needed for the general public. Reserve them for healthcare workers. And so, of course, understandably, libertarians right now who think this whole thing is a hoax or whatever is blown out of proportion are sharing that to show they lied to it. And my point is, yes, that's true. But look at what they said back then. They said, you don't need them public. Save them for healthcare workers. So number one, that makes no sense. Why would they be good for healthcare workers if they're pointless? But also, like when it comes to guns, the government also says, hey, you citizens don't need, you private people don't need guns. The police have them. So libertarians don't conclude, oh, I guess guns don't work. They say, I want to go get a gun because apparently, you know what I mean? So that's weird that the people who think masks don't do anything. But that's kind of just rhetorical. I've seen people who simultaneously say the masks can't possibly help with coronavirus because look at the diameter of the coronavirus itself. Look at the porousness of the mask. You know, it fits through, so duh. And they say, and I don't want to wear these things because CO2 can't leave easily and I'll get a headache or I might collapse in the store. Well, I just quickly checked and the diameter of the coronavirus is 364 times that of a CO2 molecule. So mm-hmm. again, it's not whether that's right, but just internally, that doesn't make any sense. And then last thing I'll say is people have been touting this guy, Alex Berenson, is, oh, wow, he's speaking the truth. I don't know if they realize his other big book is called Tell Your Children. Oh, and by the way, just in case you don't know who he is or some of the listeners don't, he's like a COVID-19 truther. All right. Or, you know what I mean? Like he's on Twitter, he's real big on, you know, wait a minute, you told us that Georgia was going to be dead by now and it's not. And you know, so he's like the new hero. He's a former New York Times reporter of a lot of libertarians who, you know, don't like all this lockdown and stuff. And my point is, okay, you know, maybe he's right on this stuff, but this guy also is the author of a book called Tell Your Children, quote, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. And I'm reading it from his website. An eye-opening report from an award-winning author and former New York Times reporter reveals the link between teenage marijuana use and mental illness in the hidden epidemic of violence caused by the drug. Facts the media have ignored as the United States rushes to legalize. Right? That doesn't prove he's wrong about coronavirus, but I'm just saying it's weird to me how people who don't like the lockdowns, in which I don't, you know, in principle, you know, if an asteroid's coming, it's going to destroy the Earth, and there's one rich guy who has a laser to stop it, and he doesn't want to use it, I don't think it's justified to force him to do it. You know what I mean? Like that's what I'm saying. You know, I'm against violation of property rights. Doesn't matter what the consequences are. So, of course, I'm not for political lockdowns, but to me, there's a lot of libertarians, because they don't like that, they will latch on to anybody who comes along and says something, even if it's internally contradictory. And I'm just concerned that that makes it look like to non-libertarians who think that we're selfish and stupid and don't understand science, it's like confirming all that stuff on some issue. Again, I know there's tons of stuff of people saying dumb things, and the WHO is just ridiculous. Like they contradict themselves every week. So right. I get all that. But anyway, I'm done ranting. I just wanted to get that off my chest. So I like what you're doing. And I don't know if
Can I add something to that?
Certainly.
Because I think back in April, we saw the beginning of those anti-lockdown protests, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a very lively one in Michigan. They had one here in New Hampshire. And immediately, the mainstream media created these two positions, right? Like, so immediately what happens is it's like, there is no middle, there is no discussion, there is no back and forth, there's these two extremes, pick. So these pictures started to emerge of these really kind of like sloppy and idiotic looking anti-lockdown protesters mm-hmm. with Trump hats hanging out of pickup trucks with poorly written signs. All of these clips that we saw over and over and over again. And I don't know what the questions reporters were asking, like as prompts to keep getting the same response, but it's like, I just want to get a haircut. I just want to need my hair done. You know? So it's like, well, you know,
was Jamie
here we
Crane
are, America.
These protests? What you drinking on?
But in CNN's presentation, it's like, here we are, America, choose. Are you with responsible science person? Are you with Neil deGrasse Tyson and Greta Thunberg and the World Health Organization, the CDC? Are you with this Trump-loving idiot hanging out of a pickup truck, which is obviously a false dichotomy, but it was the one that was presented. And I think that a thoughtful libertarian's, I don't want to say it's our job, like we have a duty to do this, but a worthwhile project, I think, as yes, this is a controversy again, right? Since a lot of the social justice stuff just died down because, you know, people get fatigued. If people aren't true revolutionaries, they get fatigued very easily. They always need something, but they can't stick with one thing for very long.
Right.
And, you know, the media laser cat, laser in front of approach to like news cycles is obviously, I think, a huge part of that. And social media is too. But so now we're back to the mask controversy and the cynical response, just as what I think might be happening. And again, this is tinged with my own cynicism from observations is, you know, Daniel Kahneman has that book, System 1 and System 2,
yep.
Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yep.
And so I think one thing that we've really seen in the last 5 years is people very impulsively act. They decide, right? But those decisions or actions are very emotionally driven. But because we're rational creatures, we know we can't go, oh, I just did it because I had this crazy moment or I lost control or I didn't know what I was doing. So that's not a good explanation of why we do something. Certainly not a good explanation of who we vote for. So we have to backfill it with some rational sounding, explanation of why we did that. So Kahneman kind of lays this out for people who are unfamiliar. There's System 1, which is that sort of fast, like survival oriented kind of thinking, not really processing everything and just making a snap decision that is very much emotionally driven. And one very powerful emotion is fear and shame, or the desire to avoid shame is tied up in that as well. And System 2 is more of that deliberate approach to, you know, weighing evidence and making a more logical decision about something. So people act System 1 and then backfill System 2.
Mm-hmm.
So I think things around masks seem to break out pretty well along political lines, where a mask is an imposition. Masks are a big government program. And for the left, masks are science, right?
And this is
just like the most base kind of simple emotional thinking about it. I've seen doctors and nurses wear masks. Masks are good. I'm on the side of science. Mm-hmm. So in very, very simple thinking terms, it's very easy for things to break out along those lines. And obviously libertarians are going to line up more with the right on this one. Then people go and they backfill with whatever study they see. Mm-hmm. But as the mask controversy reemerges, I see a lot of like left-wing people on my social media news feeds posting this Forbes article that's like, hey, masks are just what you do if you're a caring and responsible person, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. This is just my way of showing that I'm a decent member of society, which is basically so much of what the signaling the left tries to do all the time.
Right.
So as a libertarian, I might say, okay, you know what? I'll concede that. And if I go out, like in practice, if I'm going into the local like health food store where I know everybody's going to be wearing a mask, it's no imposition for me to put one on for 5 minutes, regardless of what I think. It doesn't even matter what I think. I think it's a courtesy to do it. But this whole, like, so the Forbes headline is, you're a good person if you do this. So the pattern interruption that we could create is like, okay, I agree with you about the masks. What's your line in the sand for that fill in the blank? What's your line in the sand? You're a good person if you blank. Because we're probably going to be playing that fill in the blank game in this country for a long time around this COVID thing, especially if there is, you know, a really powerful second wave in the fall. You're a good, responsible member of society if you blank. What? Stay locked in your house? Is that your line in the sand? Subject your child to an untested vaccine? Is that your line in the sand? If you, you know, stand by idly as the government completely destroys the economy by keeping all these business closed, like, where's your line in the sand? But know what it is, because the fill in the blanks are going to keep, you know, coming for some time, I think.
Yes. And I think, by the way, just so you know, Brett, I'm venting, because what I just said to you there, I don't think I've ever said that in all one spot yet. Like I said, people who follow me on Twitter and see me troll people, other libertarians probably get a sense. It seems like something's bothering Bob. What is it? But so I just said, I said that because I know you've got the facts of what, like, you can, you know, respond the way probably half the or 75% of my audience wanted to. So let me, again, it's where I'm coming from, though. And I agree that, and that's why it's so infuriating, the stupid left, or not the stupid left, the petty dictator left.
Yeah.
So instantly, if something is good, why not just mandate it? Because they don't understand there's a lot, like the American spirit and what, like a lot of things, like that means now there's a bunch of people who on principle are not going to do it because it's like, screw you. You're telling me I have to. And it makes it difficult that I think in the absence of a political order, there would be plenty of businesses, and perhaps not because they had experts who did the science, but just because the public was swayed by CNN or whatever, but just, you know, to avoid controversy, the easy thing would have just been to post a sign saying to come into this store, like no shirt, no shoes, no mask, no service. And then it would have been a property rights issue. Now, again, so without any political order, and then, you know, most libertarians, at least if they were to be consistent, would have to say, oh, yeah, it's a store, even though I think it's stupid. If they want me to put a cloth around my face, I guess I have to because I believe in private property, or that's what I've been saying for 10 years on Facebook. And so, in other words, the same people who say private businesses have the right to post a sign saying no Jewish people can shop here and the Civil Rights Act was stupid, they're right now going nuts about the horror of a store making me put a mask on. And the one thing they can link to say, no, I'm not being against it, is no, the government's making them. And I know no store owner in America would want me to put a mask on if it were really up to him or her. And I empirically, I don't know if that's true, but we don't know because the stupid progressives mandated it. So, so there's that element of it. So it's like, for example, with, you know, 9/11, there's a wide range of libertarian views on that. Like some people think, you know, oh yeah, government certainly overreacted. Some people go so far as to say it was an inside job. There's nobody who says 9/11 didn't happen. And I'm saying with the coronavirus, it's the weirdest thing to me where the spectrum has been expanded to include, no, there's no one dying from this. That's all, you know, dying with COVID-19, not from it. And I've talked to people who literally believe this is nothing, as opposed to it's been exaggerated like crazy. And so anyway, do you want to, I'm just venting at this point.
We need to vent. I think this is, I'm glad that we've provided a forum for that, because I think I need it too. I was telling you before we started, I did a lot of it yesterday with Steve Patterson, who I know has been a guest on your show. And I mean, we just, I think the exploration that's really important is, it's like, yeah, we understand just with the 9/11 example that there's lots of misinformation. There's lots of lies. There's lots of attempts at manipulation, right? But just because you have the presence of those things doesn't mean that there were no airplanes and the towers were knocked down by directed energy weapons from space. But that is like a form of an argument that exists around it. Mm-hmm. And obviously COVID-19 is no different. So I think that the curious, as long as you don't get busted, like I talked about early, where if somebody says to me, you're not really curious, you already know what you think about everything, and you're just playing a Socratic game here. But
as if that's like, would they have said that to Socrates? Like, who do you think you are? Yeah.
Yeah, but I in person, I mean, social media is one thing, and I'm trying to behave better there. But in person, I really think that is a worthwhile approach, and just asking questions. And questions are always a really good way to, if you care about people and you want them to do better and you want them to think harder, subjecting, you know, their statements and their positions to questions is a great way to encourage that, because they might realize they're not standing on much of a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, you know, a nice favor we can do for the people that we care about, instead of just berating them, like is that's what I used to do in the old days. And,
right.
and like I said, burned a lot of bridges. And there was a lot of valuable information that could have been moved across those bridges when they were there. But I burned them, uh-huh. right? Because that was like new libertarian system one, I know something you don't know kind of thinking. So trying to do a better job than that today.
Okay, well, I know we could probably be talking for hours more on this.
Oh, yeah.
But I know we both have time constraints here. So if, my guest, folks, has been Brett Benoit, excuse me. I told you before, and I wasn't going to make your name French, and I just did. folks, the links, I'll put all kinds of links, including to my Wheels on Liberty parody that I did at Porkfest 1 year. I sent it to you, but I don't know if you actually saw it. I sent it to you on Facebook and you didn't answer me like years ago. I'm putting you on the spot.
I'll go back and find it. I will go back and find it. This is the interview with the zombie?
No, not that one. It was the one where I was doing Wheels Off Liberty and I was doing you and Jamie. So my impression of Jamie was decent. You, I didn't even try. I was like the straight man.
Oh, I'm honored that such a thing exists. And also, Bob, I have to be on the record before we leave here of apologizing to you for whatever pork fest that is. It was 2012, right? Now, you say to me and Jamie, we're going to do this interview with a zombie thing. And I didn't know that this was like a major libertarian comedy phenomenon between you and Tom Woods. I didn't have that background information. Like, I didn't know that I should be honored to be interviewed by a zombie, because this is like one of the most viral in 2012. It was probably the most viral libertarian video in the world. So I'm just kind of sitting there like, and we're on stage and I'm going, I don't get what this is.
Right.
So I wish, because that's one of the, if I say, do you know who Tom Woods is? Do you know who Bob Murphy is? The first video I would show them is the bloopers from the interview with the zombie. So I blew it. I blew it.
But
I
don't just know so if people we'll get what chance. Was funny, you said, so again, folks, the setup, we're on stage and I'm the zombie interviewing you. And was Jamie there too? Yeah, Jamie was there.
Yes, yeah.
And because he said some dirty stuff that was fun. And I'm conducting the interview, folks, as the and Brett actually like says almost under his breath, like, you're just saying one word things. What do you want us to do up here? And I was like, yeah, because I'm a zombie. So anyway, that was good. That's good stuff. Okay, but in any event,
well, this today we made up for it today, Bob. This was great. I had such a great time.
Yeah, thank you. And this was good. So at about, I'll send it to you, Brett. Yeah, I did a skit where I was doing you and Jamie, and it was good. Oh man, it was good stuff. It was
awesome.
It's too bad we got to save the world, because we could just be such entertainers. We have so many gifts.
I agree.
So much to give. Okay.
Right.
Thanks. Joking aside, thanks, Brett, for being part of the show, and good luck with everything you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.